Hello, this is Tom McCaffrey.
Hey, this is Alex Bechera.
And you're listening to
Last Exit to Brooklyn on Storic Media Podcast Network.
the most important podcast of our time, right?
Yeah.
You don't sound too sure.
It's
Isn't it the most important podcast?
a podcast. You're listening to a podcast.
Okay. Welcome to Last Exit to Brooklyn, a podcast. Hey everybody. Welcome to Last Exit to Brooklyn. Thanks for tuning in. Please rate and review. We're on Storic Media Podcast Network now. I'm here with Eric Bronstein. I'm
A
Tom
big,
McCaffrey. How's
yeah.
it going?
Sorry, Tom McCaffrey. Sorry, I didn't want to talk over
McCaffrey,
you.
yeah. Yeah, that opening's always weird. I think I'm just not good at that whole like, hey everyone.
No,
That's
you're
why
good.
yeah, I'm great. That's why I hated like emceeing because you kind of had to be that kind of personality, you know, like, hey everyone, we're gonna have a great show, you know. And if you know me, I'm not that guy.
You're
I'm
not
always
that
like, this
guy.
is gonna be a shit show.
Yeah.
We're gonna have a great. How's it going? There's a few things we want to talk about, right? Well, first we have a guest coming on,
Yeah, great guest.
Ophira Eisenberg from
So good.
NPR Radio. And is NPR Radio redundant? What does it stand for? National Public Radio? Is that
Oh
what I'm
yeah, I
saying?
guess it
National
is,
Public
yeah.
Radio. Radio. Kind of like saying ATM machine. But so I want to talk about you want to talk about the RNC, right?
Yeah.
So, but before we do that, we were talking about something that's even more relevant. I just watched rewatched the Brian De Palma movie Dressed to Kill last night from 1980. And you know, and the only reason I did is because, you know, like I was watching the RNC and I just couldn't take it. It was so like, well, first of all, did you watch all every night of the RNC?
Yeah, pretty much. And I just was taken how many flags there were. There were so many
I
flags. It's
know.
like
I wanted
they
to be
were
like, all right,
overcompensating.
dude. What country are we in? Yeah, it was insane. And I mean, it was creepy. I mean, I felt like most of the people who talked were just awful, and they
Yeah.
literally sound. They were all exactly the same, and they looked like these kind of like worn down drones. That were
Yeah.
just kind of, it reminded me of there was an old skit on SNL where it was like a hypnotist show, and they were interviewing people who had just come out of the show, and they were all saying how great the show is because
Oh, that's
they've been
funny.
hypnotized, and they're just like, "It's the greatest show I've ever seen, much better than Cats." I'm gonna see, and like every speech reminded me of that. Like they were just like, "Donald Trump is the greatest president. He will save everybody." Did you notice that? That they just all seemed the same kind of energy and tone. It was all flat.
Yeah, and a lot of the speakers were coked up, like Donald
Do you think that's
Jr.
true?
I don't know. He his eyes were all red. I don't know. I
I
mean,
mean, the one chick seemed totally fucking coked up or crazy.
Guilfoyle.
Yeah, that was like disturbing to watch. She was like yelling the whole time.
Yeah. And then with his speech last night, I watched part of it. I couldn't anymore. It was just.
Why? Because it's just all lies. What scared me about it is like, and I don't, how are they getting away with all this shit? Aren't they like violating all these constitutional acts
Like the
where you
hatch.
can't do that, where you can't use the White House to, you know, promote your political party?
I think it violates the Hatch Act, which Trump has
It
violated
does.
so many times. And he why would he's committed so many crimes. Why does he care about the
So
hatch?
why? So he can just do it, and no one ever. Because everyone kept saying it's violating the Hatch Act, but it's like, well, how come no one does anything about it?
Well, here's another example. You remember a couple of weeks ago where he signed the executive orders for the unemployment and stuff? And
Yeah.
people are like, you can't do that. And then he just did it, and then he kind of did it.
But doesn't it mean he did it, but it doesn't go through? It doesn't mean anything?
Well, the thing is, no one wants to fight him on it because it's money for the people. So basically, a president can't add to the budget, but he can move money around with an executive order, kind of. And that's what he did with this.
But I mean, is it going to go through? Because I don't think
Yeah.
people are getting money, are they?
Yeah, it's going to be for like 3 weeks, though. It's stupid.
That should, what is it, like
Yeah.
$900? That should, I don't,
It's going
yeah,
to
I
be
mean,
less because they're taking it from FEMA. And FEMA now is going to have to spend out a lot of money on these hurricanes that are coming.
yeah. I mean, one takeaway from his speech and the whole thing is that and a lot of people are saying this, he's acting like he hasn't, he's not president right now. Uh-huh. They just keep saying how Biden, that's the whole thing I don't understand how people are falling for. Like, oh my God, or, you know, there's so much violence and destruction and you're not safe anymore, you know, and you're, and it's like, but you're the president. So what? I don't know how they've pulled that off, like blaming that on Biden somehow. That
he only runs as an outsider. He can't run on his record, so he has to run as an outsider.
Yeah, but it just, but I mean, I think what's scary is just people are so stupid and they just don't. Is that what it is? No one knows anything, so that he says things and everyone's like, yeah. And so white people are just scared because he's like, because didn't they really? I mean, they're literally like, if you elect Biden, like, there people are going to come to your house and kill you.
Yeah. Well, it's. That's where the incumbent has an advantage all the time, because the incumbent is like the devil, you know, so you can always play that card where, oh, if you elect this guy, I mean, it may not be great now, but if you elect this guy, it's going to get worse. And it's kind of hard to play that card with Biden because he was already kind of, you know, he's
no. I just don't. I mean, it's that thing where. You know, you just get so frustrated because it's something you can't do anything about. So you're just kind of finally like. So anyway, that's why I put on Dress to Kill. Let me put on something more inspiring and less horrifying. A movie about a woman, a transsexual murder. That movie is very ahead of its time. It's about like transsexuals.
Yeah, I don't remember. I know it was a kind of a big ripoff of Psycho, though.
Yeah, there's a lot, you know, well, you know, De Palma loved Hitchcock, and right. There's a lot of homages in his movies to Hitchcock, and I didn't realize there's so many in this one. First of all, there's like two shower scenes with a woman like getting attacked, and then Angie Dickinson is the main character, and she gets killed within like half an hour of the movie, so it's kind of like that. Yeah. It kind of does the same thing Psycho does, where he kind of like tricks you. And then there's something else too. There's another.
Yeah, oh, from what I remember, borrowed heavily from Psycho.
Also, the whole thing, it ends up, it's a man dressing as a woman killing people. So yeah, it's like, literally Psycho, basically.
Still better than the Vince Vaughn version.
Yeah, that was horrendous. But what was so weird about, wait, what?
The Vince Vaughn version.
Did I see it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw it. It was just fucking awful.
They're like, oh, we're going to do a shot-for-shot remake. I'm like, then why are you doing this?
Why do you think they did? Because it was Gus Van Sant did it. Well, I mean, he clearly knows what he's doing. Why would he do that?
I guess because people loved Psycho so much, and they thought it was such this thing you could never touch. So I thought he could get around it by saying, I'm just going to shoot every scene exactly the same. But then why do it?
Yeah, so but why did no one say no? Why not just not do it? It's such an odd.
Yeah, why would you?
I guess he's
do
weird.
It?
What?
Why would you want to do it as the director or an actor? Make a movie that's been made exactly. You know.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm gonna do that with a movie with Point Break.
Bill and Ted 3 coming out.
Yeah, that. What do you? All right, so the last thing I want to say about Dress to Kill is like. I remember young watching it and Angie Dickinson's in it and she's like hot in it, even though she's like old in it. And I remember when I saw it when I was like 13 or 14 and
she
it was
like
known
the first
as
big cougar, you know,
what
she was the first big MILF.
Yeah. Right. Cause I mean, wasn't she in our age? Like, do you remember that thinking she was hot even like young? Like,
yeah, I think
she was
so.
Older?
I think like seeing, oh, that's a good looking older woman.
And but she seems so old in it, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, oh my God! Like, and she's basically like my age when she did it. That's what's trippy now about getting older, seeing shit like that. The only thing I will say is I feel like people looked older back then than they do now.
Yeah, you ever see like those old things? Like that guy was 32, you know, like Lou Costello, and they're like, he was 16, you know.
Why did they look so bad? No one was taking care of themselves? No plastic surgery?
I think it was, yeah, diet, food, smoking. Smoking's probably the big one.
She must have taken care of herself because she still looks, like looking at it now, I mean, I know she looks good in it. Like she, right. Even though she, like young, she looked really old, like when I was young. But now I'm like, oh my God, like she, She was super hot, yeah. That chick.
I saw some old movie recently with Jane Fonda. She was smoking back in the day.
She was. I remember discovering that later, because by the time we knew Jane Fonda, she kind of was older and wasn't as hot. But then, like, you look, when she's young, she's like really hot.
Yeah.
She had a lot, I've listened to podcasts about her. She kind of had a lot of flack because she got really political.
Yeah, of course. So she went on a North Vietnamese tank.
Yeah, the Hanoi Jane thing. Yeah. And then she had a lot of things. She was like part of the Black Panthers at one point.
Right.
Some shit like that.
But the Vietnam thing, people never, I understand that. I mean, it's one thing to be against the war, but it's the other thing to like help the enemy kill Americans. That's a little.
Yeah, but that's kind of not what she was doing. I listened to a podcast with her, and she wasn't really, everything got spun into a, it was kind of propaganda. She wasn't like on the Viet Cong side or anything.
Probably not, but if you sit on one of their tanks and you're hanging out with their leaders, it's probably.
Well, that was the thing she talks about, how she sort of got tricked into doing that.
Yeah, well, that's what she says.
Yeah, I guess that's a good. Yeah. Excuse, but I don't know. It's possible. She kind of gave it. So Bill and Ted. So new Bill and Ted's coming out. What do you? I think it's out today. So what does that mean? It's like online now.
Yeah. Well, I think they caught a break because, you know, if that movie came out in the theater, that could be a wipeout. But since there's so little content,
Are you gonna watch it? Did you like the other Bill and Ted's?
I liked them, but I thought this was going to be horrible. And then I read a lot of reviews, and the reviews were good.
What did they say?
They said it was good. But you see the trailer, you're like, this looks like a disaster. Because it's them just old doing the same shit. But
well, I thought it like probably would be okay, because I was like, if they're doing it, it's they must have like thought there was something to it. Because Keanu Reeves isn't like doing badly.
He doesn't he's really doing great.
The other guy probably needed it.
But it's a good script, though. Probably the movie was a really good script.
That's what I mean. It was probably a good script, and it's funny. I'm sure they got Alex Winter on board immediately. This is my impression.
They could have said it was porn, right?
This is my impression of them asking Alex Winter to do it. Hey, Alex. We're thinking of doing another Bill, and I'm in. Okay, that was easy.
Wasn't he like kind of on MTV for a while? I kind of remember something like that.
Yeah, you know, he went to NYU Film School, and he wanted to be like a filmmaker, and he was into like comedy. And he did Bill and Ted, and then he and his like, you know, whatever, I don't know, the guy he produced stuff with, had a show on MTV called The Idiot Box, which is kind of like, again, like kind of ahead of its time, where I think it was like short comedy sketches. And I think it just ate shit, you know? And then he made a movie called Freaked. Did you ever hear that?
Sounds familiar.
And apparently it was like this kind of low budget movie that him and his friend wanted to do, and they couldn't sell it. And then they got a deal with some studio who like put all this money into it. Then it became this big, because I listened to an interview of him recently, and it became this huge budget, like $20 million, which was like a lot bigger than they had thought. And then the studio execs kept being like, you got to do this, you got to do that. And he said it kind of got totally changed from what it was.
They always say that crap, though.
You're right. I mean, I don't, but
it was a good thing, and then I know what happens. I hear that.
They made us make it bad. I mean, I just know from, I don't know, like I've seen that happen. I've been in a room of stuff like that where like they come in and they're like, no, this, I mean, it does happen.
I know a couple of times I've seen it like, this was our original idea and they changed it. And the original idea sounds bad too. So
yeah, I think that, yeah. But like, I think what happened too is then the guys that greenlit the movie like left or got fired. And so when they were done with it, they showed it to the studio people and they were like, this is shit. And I think they like barely, I think they shelved it for a couple of years and then they kind of released it, but barely. And then like, but it's kind of become this cult movie where people act like it's just, you know, this movie that was kind of like overlooked. It's a comedy, but I watched it recently, like a month ago online, and it's not fucking good. It's just so weird and over the top. And Keanu Reeves is in it as like a dog. Cause they get lost in like, they take a wrong turn. They get lost in like a freak show where they kidnap people and turn them into freaks and then make it a freak show they have to perform. And Keanu Reeves is one of the, like, Mr. T is in it, like, yeah. Bobcat Goldthwait. And
this doesn't sound like a good movie.
Well, do you remember there was a movie called Freaks that's really old, from like the 40s?
Oh, yeah, that's like, yeah, okay.
That's kind of like a cult movie. It was sort of an homage of that. Like, they were kind of like remaking that, but like in a comedy way. And if you rewatch it, it's really fucking bad.
Why is there always
And then apparently he like quit showbiz after that.
Well, I can see that.
Because he said he worked on it for like 2 years and put all this money, and then they like shelved it. And then he said he kind of had a problem. But actually, in the interview, kind of sounds smart, because then he said he went and like started his own production company in Europe. So he was like shooting commercials and stuff. So he was doing pretty well. But again, it was kind of like, wow, that's such a smart thing to do, because he was like a young Hollywood guy, and he kind of had it kind of bottomed, like his career hit a big speed bump. And instead of staying and being like, oh, I'm going to like still try and do this, he was like, you know what, I don't want to fucking be here anymore.
Well, with the Bill and Ted thing, the one thing people forget about it is that was kind of the beginning of the surf dude kind of thing. It kind of created that genre, I think. Maybe Spicoli a little bit on Fast Times at Ridgemont High, but that was kind of like a peripheral character in the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
that is funny to think about. It's basically two Spicolis are the stars of the movie.
Right. And it went up for years, even up to like the Kumar, Harold and Kumar, and then
the whole kind of the stoner movie.
Yeah.
You know who's in Bill and Ted? It's so weird. It's like one of the Go-Go's, one of the chicks from the Go-Go's.
Oh, really?
He plays Joan of Arc. And that's another movie apparently they made and they shelved for like 2 years. I don't know. I think they didn't know what to. And again, I think that was a movie I think they released and didn't expect anything of it, and it became a big hit. And then,
Bill and Ted?
Yeah. And it's funny how it like really propelled Keanu Reeves. And then the other guy just, I wonder why that happened. Like,
well, I kind of feel like Keanu Reeves, his career wasn't going well, so he agreed to do this. And then now he's blown up. So now he's like, oh.
You mean like recently you think his career wasn't going that well?
Yeah, before John Wick, it was a nightmare. You know,
Because I thought, but those have been going on for years, right?
Yeah, 4 or 5 years. But I think, you know, you agree. I heard this movie was in development for like at least 10 or 12 years, you know?
Yeah.
2012, Keanu Reeves is like, yeah, I'll do this movie. Now he's like,
Either that, or maybe he was just like, yeah, that'll be fun. They threw a lot of money at him and maybe thought it'd be fun.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's not like he's, you know, getting tons of roles, but he has made a major comeback.
Do you remember the second? Did you see the second one?
I liked the second one. I think I liked it more.
Really? I really did. I thought the second one's not that good. Bogus Journey.
The whole thing with the, you know, where they make fun of the Ingmar Bergman movie, you know, where he's playing, you know, chess with
death.
Death.
What Ingmar Bergman movie is that?
I don't know. It's like a famous scene, though. I forgot what it's called.
Death Takes a Holiday or something?
No, it's some weird name, but something to do with death. And it's a famous thing where the guy's playing death chess for his soul. And then he starts playing. And then in the movie, right, they're playing like Monopoly and Sorry. That was really funny.
I thought it was funny. I feel like it got a little, I don't know. It got convoluted. Actually, that was the summer Point Break came out. So it was like,
that
was kind of one of Keanu Reeves's like big movie summers.
Jesus Christ.
Point Break. And that's what I love about Point Break is, you know, cause he was already known as the Bill and Ted character. And right. Like, if you remember Point Break, he's supposed to be this kind of like very ambitious FBI agent who's just kind of like new on the force. And he's a lawyer. He went to law school, and they're like, yeah, you know, we want you to be pretend you're a surfer to like infiltrate these guys. And he's like, he's in a suit and he's like, who's ever going to believe that I'm a surfer? Like, he even like says that, you know, and it's like, dude, you totally sound exactly like a fucking surfer.
You'll figure it out.
He's like, no one's going to believe that I smoke weed and surf.
No one believes that was an FBI agent. That's what no one would believe.
I know. He's a lawyer. It's so weird, but it's funny how... he keeps saying that, like, I don't know, man. And then like he literally just steps on the beach and immediately everyone's like, yeah, you're a surfer. What do you mean?
Well, I bet you this Bill and Ted is going to do well because...
Because no one has anything else to do because it's the only movie that's come out in the last 3 months.
Yeah.
But I do think nostalgically, too.
Right. Yeah, but you know what the real thing is? The original movie is so old now. You know, sometimes you can go too far back.
And, that's what I'm like, you know, I understand the nostalgia, but I mean, it's been like 30 years. I mean, it's too fucking long.
Right. And you know when that happened? Remember in the 90s, they would always do these nostalgia movies, you know, from old TV shows.
Yeah. Like they would make like Charlie's Angels.
Right. Or the Brady Bunch. But those were always, it was always from the 70s, but sometimes they would go back too far because they just wanted to do any movie and they do like Beverly Hillbillies and McHale's Navy and shit. And those movies were bombs because I'm like, that's just too far back.
Because people like McHale's Navy. Did they make a movie, McHale's Navy?
Yeah, I think it was like Steve Martin or something. It was like terrible.
Was it like because the people – because, yeah, I didn't know McHale's Navy. I was like, what is this shit?
I think 20 years is the thing. It's like people when they're young and then they're 10 and then when they hit 30, they remember all the good stuff when they were 10 or 11.
Yeah. You know? This one doesn't really make me feel nostalgic. This one just kind of is throwing in my face how old I am. That's why I'm like, oh, man.
Yeah.
Because Keanu Reeves, like the other guy actually kind of looks the same. Keanu Reeves looks like so much older now. Yeah. Like he still looks good, but he just like the other guy kind of still looks how he did back then. And how are they going to do it? I mean, they're like 55 years old, but they're just still like...
Well, I think they have kids in it or something like that.
Yeah, they do. They have daughters and...
That doesn't seem like anything.
What are you looking at? Is Ophira coming on?
Yeah, I'm just trying to see. Anyway, keep going. Sorry. I don't want to lose
the moment. So another thing about it. Oh, and you know what another movie I watched right before Dressed to Kill was Sliver. Do you remember that movie?
Yeah. That's with like a slither, like that thing that like sucks everybody in and stuff.
No. That's Slither. This is Sliver. It was from the 90s. It's Sharon Stone. It's right after Basic Instinct.
Oh, yeah. That's a terrible movie.
William Baldwin.
They're spying on each other.
It's a movie that I remember when it came out, and it was the same guy who I guess wrote Basic Instinct. So right. It's kind of a hot movie. You know, he like it was billed as his hot movie because Sharon Stone had just done Basic Instinct. Mm-hmm. And I guess I saw it when it came out, and it's like, if you rewatch it, there's literally nothing to the movie. It's literally like Sharon Stone moves into, and I don't even, they call it Sliver. I don't even know why. Cause of the building building is like a weird building.
I think it was one of those movies where they had a big director. They had like her, built William Baldwin, and it just
Tom Berenger's in it.
Yeah. It was like, they had all the elements.
It's so funny now thinking of how that was like a powerhouse cast. We got Tom Berenger. And then she moves in and William Baldwin's like really hot, I guess. And he owns a building. He's rich and he just starts banging her. And then he like, she goes to his apartment and he has this room. He like spies on everyone in the building. He has cameras everywhere in the room.
We have our guest.
All right. We have our guest logging on right now. We'll talk about Sliver later.
I know everyone's dying to hear about it.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi, good. I was actually just looking for my AirPods.
Oh, okay. Do you need a minute?
Why can I never find this? Okay, let me just look one place.
Yeah.
No problem. Well, Sliver.
Back to Slither. Is it Slither? Slither.
No, it's Sliver with like a V.
Okay. I think it had that UB40 song that was a cover.
Well, that was the thing. That was the only thing that came out of it that anyone cared. They really pumped that song that summer because no one wanted to see the movie. So right. They kept showing that video.
Yeah, that's the one. Back in the day, there was like that mannequin movie that you always like to bring up. It was this movie bombed, but the song.
I don't know. How do you feel about no AirPods? Are you married to AirPods?
No. You sound good.
No, you sound fine. Can you hear us?
Oh, yeah. No.
Okay, good. All right. So, our guest is here. We were talking about her before.
Great guest.
She's a great guest, a great comedian. She hosts her own show on NPR radio, which I think is redundant, saying NPR radio, right?
Well, it is true that some of their products are only podcasts.
Oh, but I meant because isn't it National Public Radio? So if I say NPR radio.
But then it's NPR podcast, right? I guess you only have to say it to define that it's only available on radio. MPP is a terrible name for a company, by the way.
Yeah. And so the podcast she hosts is called Ask Me Another.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And it's like comedy trivia, right?
Yeah.
It's Ophira like, Eisenberg, by the way.
Ophira, oh yeah, Ophira Eisenberg. Let her hear it, yeah. Thanks. Thanks for coming on.
Production.
Thanks. Oh,
it's
pleasure.
Good to see you. Are you in New York?
Yeah, I'm in Brooklyn. I'm in my apartment in Brooklyn, in my bedroom. But the reason I was trying to find my AirPods before this, the reason I can't find them is because basically, right over there is a husband and a four-year-old. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times when I'm doing Zoom shows, like they're my roommates. I go to a different neighbor's apartment in the building. Sometimes it's just so loud.
Oh, right, right.
And also, you can't explain to a four-year-old, like, don't walk in, you know, just because doors, what are doors? It's his house.
Yeah, exactly. I miss those days.
So the one advantage you have of doing a Zoom show, staying home, you can't even stay home for?
Like, I know. I was actually thinking the other day, and our lives are so hectic, that even though it's supposed to be, you know, I guess less hectic right now because where are we going? But it feels more hectic because we have nowhere to go. Someone suggested, like, you know, doing the show from my bathroom, which is right there. And I was just thinking about the fact that it would probably have to happen while someone was showering or bathing.
Okay. That does not sound conducive to doing a show.
Maybe.
So are you you're doing your show just at home now, or you usually go to someone else's apartment?
No, yeah, just from home. Yep. Used to be at the Bell House, and now it's from my
Did your podcast at the Bell House?
Yeah, they used to pack it in. I mean, they will again, but, right? You get a lot of people there, right?
Yeah. It was basically – I feel like it was always pretty good, but then depending on who, like, the special guest was, of course, you would get – and sometimes we had – you know,
Patrick Stewart.
That was definitely a time that people packed in, and, you know. Through different events and stuff, you know, we've offered tickets like, oh, if you charity, fine, we'll auction off a couple tickets to a live taping. And of course, those people, you know, get those things like, fantastic, come to a live taping. And then you don't hear from them for years. And then you have like Patrick Stewart on, they're like, I'm available. You're like,
yeah. There you go. So you have a lot of great guests on that show, right?
Yeah. So I've talked to, yeah, now all through Zoom, but yeah.
Did you
just have Joseph Gordon-Levitt, did I see?
Yeah. And
wow.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt, that was all the three word people, because it was William Jackson Harper, Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
all the Home Improvement kids, and they all have three
names. Jonathan Taylor Thomas.
Yeah. Exactly. And Tony Shalhoub, that it's not a three-letter.
Oh, you had Tony Shalhoub?
Yeah, it was. I know it was the craziest episode. I mean, I'm doing them all separately. So when we used to do it at the Bell House, imagine all of those people being there. That would have been like, what? But now it's all separately. So when it comes together, it feels cool. But when I'm doing it, I'm like, oh, I mean, it's still cool. But it's like, oh, I talked to Tony Shalhoub and Luke Kirby on this day, and then that other day was.
So what is? How long have you been doing that show?
7 years.
Nice.
Wow.
Crazy.
So were
it's really a great show, though. I listen to a lot of NPR, but I haven't listened to it recently. I got to catch up. But
actually, Eric loves it. I remember years ago he was telling me about it a lot, to the point where I was like, stop telling me about it.
I think it got me into NPR. You made me a more sophisticated person.
I don't know if I should bring this up because he told me a story that you had Jeff Goldblum on the show.
Yeah.
And he said that Jeff Goldblum seemed like he was kind of like into you or something. Is that true?
So I wouldn't go as far as into me because I don't have the kind of self-esteem to make those statements dumb. But he was flirty.
Ah, okay.
He was a little like you went to. He was one of those people that you go to shake his hand, and he does the double hand back, and then he sort of like your hand is now within the clamshell of his hand.
Yeah. For a
while he's talking to you, and it feels like, you know, kind of I would say, what's the word? Oh, inappropriate.
Oh. Okay, I'm glad I brought that up. But what
do you, he was the fly, so come on.
Inappropriate, you know, it was like, it didn't, but he was like that. And I've heard from other people, you know, I can't even tell the lines sometimes, because that was my entire experience, and that he was, you know, great guest. I was, you know, back then I was social distancing just because that was the way we had to stand on stage, 6 feet apart. But I've been told from other people that he's very flirty and very handsy.
Ah, okay. That's so interesting how that, in the last few years, the handsy thing has taken on a whole new level.
Yes.
You know, like, it's very, I feel like handsy is like nuanced and kind of, if you get labeled handsy now, it's pretty negative.
Right, right. And I only had the clamshell. I don't know if people have had more than the clamshell hands. I mean, I will say to myself, clamshell hands, I feel like is a power move.
Really?
Like control of your hand, little lady. So I don't love that aspect. So I'm sort of like, I get to decide when my hand is in a weird hand pocket.
Right, right. That's, I've had that happen. Just, I think some people, yeah, not even like, you know, like a male female thing, but just, yeah, like a very power like, I'm in control here.
Yeah, yeah, and it's the first thing I want to do is fight. That's my first. Someone does that.
That's the first thing you want to do is fight?
Yeah, the first thing I want to do is like kick them, and so I have to really just take it.
Right. That'd probably be a bad way to open an interview with Jeff Goldblum.
You never know. And also, I mean, there was a weird intimacy between us just on a communication level, because he I believe married a Canadian and they had just had a kid. And I am a Canadian and I just had a kid or within a few months. So there was sort of like the, hey, we're in the same world right now. And we kind of were, but yeah.
Ah, that's interesting. I'm sorry I brought that up, actually, but I didn't want to make it weird.
Just came flooding back. I was like,
yeah, yeah. No, Eric, what were you?
I have a question. You are from Canada. Where again from Canada?
I grew up in Calgary.
Calgary. Do you ever feel like going back? Like and can you take me with you?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness! I was actually thinking of jumping ship like next week. I'm not even kidding. But then I found out a bunch of reasons why it would be difficult. I mean, just difficult.
Jerry Seinfeld talked you out of it?
Yes. I always look for advice from billionaires.
Yeah, that was pretty...
my life is going.
That was pretty hilarious, too, the lack of self-awareness in that article.
I thought he was being positive. I don't think it was really.
I appreciated that, but it's hard. You know, I was like, really, are you that out of touch with what's really going on? That you. I mean, you have a house in East Hampton. Like, that's not the same as, you know, being in New York City.
I am so sick of every. I mean, I think Vicky Cooperman, who's a comic I love, said it best, which is like, you don't need to write an essay if you're leaving New York. Just leave. Like you.
Right. Yeah. Whatever happened to that? People just leaving.
Just leave. But I really hate this thing that's happening right now. But like, is New York going to bounce back? Is it dead? Like, to me, it's just stupid. Because the truth is, if you look at it from a different point of view, it's just much more dire than like a think piece. I've always disliked a bunch of things that people have said about New York, because I feel like they are just not true. Like, I don't like the people like, oh, New York's going to get through coronavirus because we're tough. It's like, yeah, guess what? Virus doesn't care. Virus doesn't care how tough you are.
Okay, right.
Make decisions, have policies. It's got nothing to do with, like, brawn and strength. And then the other thing that people keep saying is that you're like, oh, is this stuff ever going to come back? Is the economy going to fall apart? Blah, blah, blah. And people go, well, New York's New York. And you're like, no, shut up. Stop with this New York. What does that mean? Oh.
Well, when did you move to New York? What year?
2001.
Yeah, you got some great timing.
Oh, wow. Did you, was it September 12th? Was it, yeah. So.
It was right before. It
was right before. Okay. Oh, and did you started comedy in Canada, right?
I did, yeah, in Toronto.
And did you have like a comedy special in Canada before you came here?
I did. I mean, it's so funny because I guess from an American point of view, I was like so new and I had a comedy special and so did a whole bunch of us.
How does that happen there? Is it just, how does that come about?
It's like, you know how they do UBI? They do that with the comics. They just give everyone a special for there.
Yeah. I mean, it was just, it's a smaller pool just to begin with.
Yeah.
But a lot of content needs to be created. So yeah, if you're pretty good and you are like working hard, you have a pretty good chance of getting quite a lot of television.
That's great.
And when you came here, were you like, all right, well, I got a comedy special and off to New York. Like,
I was such an idiot. I called up Gotham Comedy Club and I was like, hi, my name's Sophia Eisberg. I'm a comic here that just moved here from Canada. I have a comedy special on CTV. Like, do you guys even know what that is? And I've also done like the Mike Bullard show, like, you know, whatever. And they were like, great, great, great. So here's the deal. Our Bringer Night's on Tuesday. One of your friends to make a reservation. And I was like, what?
And was it like, oh shit, what the fuck, why am I here? I feel like there's a big wake-up call when you come to like a big city like that.
I know some other Canadian comedians who've come here recently and they had, you know, they had to go through the same thing. Because it's like America just, there's a lot going on in Canada. There's a lot of great Canadian comedians, but Americans don't give a shit, I guess.
No. But I mean, and we say that because we're so close, but it's not like we're not on top. Like, are you on top of what's going on in London with the British scene? I'm totally not.
I don't even know what's going on down the street here. Yeah. So,
like in Edinburgh, Edinburgh has a huge scene. Actually, all the Scottish comedians are freaking out right now because the major club, The Stand, which has clubs in Edinburgh and Glasgow and Newcastle and I think other places, might close. Ooh. So they are actually petitioning the Scottish government to like fund it.
Comedy club bailout?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That'd be a tough sell in this country.
Definitely not essential. You know what I just found out is essential? WWE. WWE.
Oh,
yeah. Well, yeah. Duh.
They did that in Florida. Because they wanted to have wrestling matches there, so the governor said, oh, this is an essential business.
Yeah. So, meanwhile, in New York, you can't have an outdoor show. They're shutting down outdoor shows.
Yeah, that's a funny thing that they were doing outdoor shows, and then now you can't do that. I guess I haven't really looked into why, but do you know why that is?
Well, supposedly, so it's any place that has a liquor license. That's what it is. So any place that has a liquor license can't charge a ticket for an outdoor show. And the theory is that there's still, like, the science behind, like, outdoor socializing is a little murky, and they don't want to promote or support anything that causes lingering.
Yeah, it's the drinking, right?
Yeah, it's the drinking. Plus, I was like, trust me, if you obviously know nothing about a stand-up comedy show, because you know what happens at the end? Everyone leaves.
Right. You don't have to worry about the comedians lingering. They're going to leave right after their set.
Out of here. Did I get my money? Did I get my free drink?
So when you moved here and you had that experience, what was your experience? I mean, obviously the comedy landscape at that point was super different. So did you have an idea of like, how did it seem to you when you got to the New York comedy scene in terms of differences from Canada? Was it like, oh shit, this is totally different?
Oh yeah, I felt slow and square. I just, like, I felt everything, like, I felt my shoes were square. I felt my clothing was baggy. I felt my act was, not, like, I just didn't feel like I was sharp. I always felt like I was super sharp.
Yeah.
Do you have a lot of metric system jokes?
I had a lot of metric systems. I had one of my best bits was about millimeters.
Well, obviously.
But also I feel like I was unaware of so many different styles. Not like people were doing all the same thing in Canada, but it sort of felt to me that everybody that was doing really well kind of had a similar style, and all of a sudden I was seeing, you know, just the real one-liner comics. That was huge. That was the huge trend when I moved here.
Was that not a thing in Canada as much?
No, there was like one guy here and there, but that kind of dry one-liner Stephen Wright style that was being kind of exemplified and turned on its head and all kinds of different things with a lot of comics here. I didn't see a ton of it.
And then when you got here, probably, because I'm from here, but I was in LA and then I moved back here about 2002. And
yeah,
Dimitri Martin was like the king of the comedy scene. So that was just, that whole style was just kind of.
Hedberg too, you know.
It was huge.
Yeah, and I'm sure you remember, but it was like, I loved Dimitri, and I still think he's really funny, but I remember getting to a point where like, every week when I'd look in like Time Out New York and like the recommended show, and it was like, this week Dimitri Martin, I'm like, all right, dude. But I mean, there's other people too that like every week just Dimitri Martin is the guy to see. It was just amazing how he was just dominating the comedy landscape. Right?
I found the scene, I was super intimidated.
It's really intimidating, right? Yeah. I mean,
intimidated for like years. Like, I feel like I was intimidating, but I'm still a little intimidated.
I know, I'm still intimidated too. But even like, because when I was started doing it here, like the alt scene became like a big scene. Yeah. And I felt like that was really intimidating.
Very intimidating. It's so weird because the alt scene, of course, is supposed to be, you know, if you just like break it down into kind of high school thing, it's like the mainstream is supposed to be the popular jocks, and then the alt scene is supposed to be the people that don't fit in, and then you come in and you're like, I don't fit in with the non-fitter inners. Like, the non-fitter inners are rejecting me because I'm not cool. Like, I didn't feel cool enough, and I was also pissed at that because I was like, who the fuck are you to tell me if I'm cool?
Nerds were more judgmental. I always thought they were more judgmental. It was scarier.
Well, and also I think that there was a misconception about that, like that it was, I guess it was people didn't fit in, that's how it started, but then it wasn't that way. They were like the cool people,
that's right,
they became cooler than like the main, it was like, this is the cool people, like, yeah, they're the weird, maybe they're a little weirder, but now they're the ones that they became the popular kids. So absolutely.
And all the club comics were just hacks.
Yeah,
just like everyone at a club was like, oh, you work a club, oh yeah, you know,
you're doing jokes and everything, hack.
Well, did you experience this at all? Because I experienced it, and I think a lot of people did, because what happened was I moved here and I was like, and the you know, I just pretty much started comedy, and everyone was like, you got to get into the clubs, that's what you do, you got to get into the clubs. And I was like, all right. And then I tried to get in the clubs and they were all like, no, we don't want you. And and then the alt scene, I could get on shows there. So I kind of did them by default because they were the only ones putting me on. And it wasn't as big yet. And then it became big. And then what happened with that is like the alt scene became like the scene to be in, and all the club people wanted to be a part of that all of a sudden.
Yep.
Do you remember seeing that kind of shift? How?
Totally. Like, I remember, you know, doing... And having, right, same as you, it's just sort of like, all right, well, I can't figure out a way to get in the club. No one, other than the comic strip, I felt there wasn't even a process. It was just sort of like, all right, just hope. Should I pray? And then just doing rooms, just rooms and rooms and rooms with friends and getting to know. And also I felt like kind of the same age as a lot of the people in the alt scene. So there was a hangout vibe.
Right.
Yeah, that definitely helped.
Yeah.
Because then it became, that became like a scene kind of. And then like, all of a sudden, famous people would be hanging out there. What? Go ahead.
Yeah, but I actually wanted to get in because you also kind of made a name for yourself, which I think was similar to the alt scene, was like the moth stuff.
Right.
Right. And Ophira is so good at, like, I mean, your brand of comedy is storytelling comedy, which is really kind of what's in now, you know, yeah, what's the most popular thing. And probably back then it wasn't as much, but I mean, you were.
And that kind of, the alt scene was sort of embracing that at the time.
Half and half, right?
Like, yeah.
I'm very grateful for the moth. I mean, just, you know, for whatever process it's worth, just because I feel like when I went there, now not a comedy stage, there were funny people on it, mm-hmm. for sure, and they were like really good comedians that did so well in that format. But for me, it actually made me believe in my voice, because I felt like the New York comedy scene, I couldn't figure out, I didn't feel comfortable being me. I was like, I'm not good enough, but I didn't know if, like, I was not a character. So it was really all pretty unhappy. And then the storytelling thing just makes you tell a true story about your life. And that got rewarded. And I was like, oh, maybe I can have confidence in my voice.
And then also, do you remember, because you probably experienced this, a lot of, you know, there's all these like weird, stupid, like feud camps in comedy where people are like, oh, you do, you know, alt scene. Cause I got branded that. People were like, he's an alt guy. And I was like, dude, I just do joke. This, first of all, what we're doing, it's fucking ridiculous that we're even doing this as a career as adults. But then did you get a lot of like, oh yeah, like storytelling? Yeah. That's like this.
I got all over the place. First of all, I some people, which this is inaccurate, but I remember people calling me Ophira, downtown queen, comedy queen, and I was like, I think that's an insult. Whatever.
That actually sounds cool.
Yeah.
I know, it's cool now. I think at the time it was like not playing uptown is all I'm trying to say.
Right. But you probably experienced it, because I remember hearing that, and I will say I did some storytelling shows, and it really is a skill that it's not any, it's a lot harder than I think people think it is. Some people cannot do it. I
think it's so hard. I actually, there's young comics, brand new comics who ask me about that. I tell them to watch you, Ophira, because
I find it very hard.
It's so, what'd you say?
I find it very hard. I think it's way harder.
Why is that? Because you can't really, you're not really relying on the laughs as much?
You can rely on the laughs, but I feel like because what it's asking of you is to create an arc. Like, you actually have to create a narrative arc, and where you end up has to be different from where you began in a satisfying way. Like, I feel like that's when it works. And so having to, like, not everything is worthy of that. There's like almost, like, you can go out and probably write 1,000, especially, you know, Tom, I think that of you, very prolific, but just write 1,000 jokes about walking down the street. Like, there's just there's probably something to be had. But is there a story walking down the street? Probably not. Like, it has to be something that's a real experience.
I think is so hard about it is that, like, if you're doing short jokes and they're not going well, you could just bail on the joke. Yeah. If you're doing a story, you're fucking, like, in the story.
But that's why you have to pepper the story with jokes throughout. That's, like, the big part of it. That's the
hard part. What is that like when you're doing a story and you're like, wow, this isn't – I don't think this is going well, but I can't do another story.
Then you have to do that thing, which does work, and I'm not saying I've always been able to do it, but it's true, where then you just have to go, it's not working, and maybe there's not a laugh in this particular part of the story in a way that's going to buy everyone back into it. So then your only choice is to be as real and honest as possible, like go for it. Find, like, don't tell the story like the person you wish you were in that story. Tell the story like the real, not very particularly attractive person that you really were in that moment, and that brings them in.
Right, because it's, you're being that much more vulnerable, so that kind of.
Yes.
I think that's the problem I had with it, because I would be telling a story and I was like, man, I'm coming off not cool enough in this story. I better. And like, also, I just couldn't, I'd feel like no one was laughing. And I'd be, if I go like too long without someone laughing, I'm like, no one likes this.
That's what makes it hard.
It's really fucking, I feel like, again, it's a thing I feel like when I was really, when the alt scene was big and I was kind of in the middle of it, I would always hear people be like, oh God, storytelling, da da da. And I was like, dude, you fucking do that.
Yeah.
And like, let's see how you fucking do.
Yeah, it is. I still find it hard, and I will be part of storytelling shows where I watch other people who do not do comedy, and maybe they are writers or in some other kind of performance, and they'll tell a really good story, and I'll just be like, "Fuck, that's like, wow, I don't know if I could do that." I mean, wow. There's just people out there that are, and they have material. Like, it's also just you have to live a life to have stories.
And also, like, some of the greatest comedians who are just considered straight-up comedians are, like, basically great storytellers.
Agreed.
Because right, when you have to do an hour, great.
Who is someone you would say is a comedian that is also, like, is almost like an undercover great storyteller where people wouldn't consider them that?
Benny is a great storyteller.
Well, he kind of was, like, he was doing – didn't he have his own show for a while where he was doing that?
He did. Yeah. And he still, I feel like when he gets up, I mean, you know, now I feel like I'm talking about another era, but I performed on a show with him at West Side Comedy Club in real life. You know, it's got to be now like 6 or 7 months ago at the earliest, right?
Yeah.
And he's just like a kind of amazing too, because he was not afraid to come in front of this club audience that was expecting just a really, like, you know, clubby and invigorating, like, back and forth, and they're a little bit drunk. And he just gets up there and patiently starts telling a story.
Yeah. And
they buy it. They buy it. Sometimes it takes a little bit of time for them to get used to the rhythm because it's so different.
Yeah.
That's the scary part when you're pulling them in. That, you know, you have to wait a minute or two to kind of get them.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, so the one great thing, too, about the mop at the time, and still, is that that's why every stand-up wanted it, is because their audiences were ridiculous. It was so popular, and it was not based on any person doing it. It was based on just the form. And so they'd pack out these venues, and no one even knew who was going to tell a story, and the audience was just so invested. So you would just kind of kill.
Nice.
Right. Yeah. That's did you win that, like,
I did. I mean, I have won, but I wasn't one of those people who I don't a lot of people cared about that.
How did the NPR show come about?
So the NPR show was an audition. But the thing I will say about the NPR show is the lesson is always be nice to everybody, because supposedly they had this idea for the show. They wanted to hire a female comedian as the host, but NPR, so they were asking around, and supposedly they saw everyone. Everyone. and I was not called in, but they saw everyone. And then they had not come up with the person. And their sound engineer, it was the same guy who recorded the live shows at the Bell House and for the Moth, and he suggested to them me, and they were like, never heard of her. And I got the job.
Wow. Really? Yeah.
So it was a sound engineer that basically got me the job.
Isn't that how, like, that's the scariest thing about showbiz. Like, I feel like everything comes down to things like that. Your whole career hinges on, like, yeah, some guy was standing there and he said something. And and if that hadn't happened, nothing would have ever happened.
I feel like my entire career has been built on other people's cancellations. And someone deciding for 30 seconds that they like me and telling that to someone else.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of the things I got were, like, I remember one of them specifically was Rena Zager was working at VH1, and she was like, yeah, I'm working on the show, and they're looking for people. And I was like, yeah, I know this guy, he's funny. It's a really good Rena Zager impression. Yeah. And I was like, yeah? And she was like, yeah, so I showed them your video. And I'm like, so what's going to happen? And she's like, I don't know. I don't know. I showed them a video. And I remember leaving like, wow, that sounds like nothing. And then they called me in like a month later, and I started doing that show. But it's like, that, you know, you think it's all like, oh, my manager's going to do this, and then I know this friend. It's just kind of like, that couldn't have been more, like, when she told me that didn't even sound like a true story to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She told someone there to watch my, she didn't even tell me who it was that she told to watch the clip. And
so casual.
Yeah. So I don't know. And it's weird because it's scary to me. You know what I mean? When you think about those little.
Right. Because people are like, it's half based on luck. And you always go, no, it's not. It's hard work and perseverance and I'm in control. And then you're like, or is it that, like, you know, the right person had a glass of wine with someone I know.
Right. And it takes you a while, I think, you know, age and wisdom to finally realize that kind of stuff. Like,
but you're great on that show. I mean, it's such a great show.
Thanks.
And all these NPR, I think, shows are really popular. I mean, they're killing it with podcasts right now.
Yeah, actually, so randomly, so there's loads of podcasts and audio is doing fine, but the numbers are a little down because people aren't commuting.
Oh,
okay. Wow. Okay.
And also, not having to pretend they're working at like in some concept of space where they're like, no, I'm just, you know, whatever, staff meeting recording or whatever. So there's a change, as they call it. They're like, we're understanding new listening habits.
Okay.
Bring them more walks.
I want to ask you, so when you started doing that, the NPR thing, was there an adjustment where you had to figure out kind of like how to, because you started doing comedy, were you like, oh, I want to, like, because interviewing is kind of like a different skill, you know what I mean?
Oh my God, totally different.
What was that like? Did you struggle with that or?
I was terrified.
Did you also, can I ask you this too? Who's the guest that you had on that you were like, I can't believe that I'm like having to talk to this person right now? Like, meaning like it was like you were starstruck with by them. Has that happened?
Yeah. I mean, Patrick Stewart, definitely. You know, I feel like so many people recently in these Zoom calls, but the Zoom calls feel, they don't feel as precious. They almost feel like they could be fake.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
You know, which is sort of kind of unfortunate, right? Because like Tony Shalhoub, I mean, I thought that was really cool. Deborah Messing, I thought that was really cool. But it's we're talking to each other, but you're just not having that thing where I'm like, I'm physically, you know?
Right.
You're just watching them on TV, kind of.
Yeah, and like interacting. It's still cool, and they, and I think they know where they are.
Yeah.
Was there
someone when you were physically there that you were like, because I've had that where I'm like
Jeff
talking
Goldblum.
To someone and I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe this person's looking at me through their eyes right now.
Yeah. Lucy Lawless was kind of a big deal for me.
Were you a big fan of that show?
Yeah.
Okay. Was that Xena?
Yeah. I'm trying to think who else I was like, oh my God. Rose Byrne, I thought was
pretty amazing.
She lives in Brooklyn, maybe still, I don't know. There's so many people too that are like, I just walked here from Brooklyn, which always, you know, my place in Brooklyn, which always makes you feel totally. Ethan Hawke in a weird way, because Ethan Hawke, I feel like I've known him almost my entire life.
Right.
So that was just sort of surreal.
That would be weird because he is someone that would, especially, I think we're around the same age. And yeah, he was definitely like an icon of our generation that kept.
He had a big comeback too. I mean, in the last 10 years at least.
Oh my God. Yeah. This was a little while ago. So it was for Boyhood. And he was, you know, talking about working with Richard Linklater. And you're just like, wow. you know, it's sort of like, this is a weird one the other way. But Tim Lyman, that's his name. So Tim Lyman wasn't that. He's the guy that has directed every great action movie. Doug Liman.
Oh, he directed Swingers and the Bourne movie, right?
Right. Yes. The one with Tom Cruise, right, where he's...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So
Edge of Tomorrow, yeah.
And at one point, as a joke, I felt like he was... I don't know where his brain was at, but he came across to me as very literal. And so at one point, I just said, so who's the best action... You know, I was so nervous asking him this. I was like, because I love action movies. I eat and breathe.
Really?
What will make you feel good right now? And I want to watch. I've watched the Bourne series again during this whole thing. I've watched
even the Jeremy Renner one. Did you like that one?
Not bad. I'll take.
Is that the one that Matt Damon's not even in it?
Yeah.
Sorry. That's when they lost me. When Bourne wasn't in it, I was like, yeah, I'm out.
Yeah, so as a joke, I said, who's the, because he also did Mr. and Mrs. Smith. So I said, so who's the better person to work with, Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, or Tom Cruise? Ha, ha, ha. It's supposed to be a joke. And he's supposed to do that thing, where a celebrity thing where they go, they're all amazing.
They're all great in their own way.
Yeah, right? And so we go, who's the best person to work with? Be real with me, Matt Damon, Brad Pitt, or Tom Cruise? And without, like, that, Tom Cruise.
Wow.
Really, like, without even thinking, Tom Cruise?
Yeah.
Did he expand on that? Like, why?
It's something you've probably heard before. He was like, that guy, he's at the set earlier than everybody else. He gets to know everybody's name. He helps everyone. He doesn't think like Eva. He's really attuned to the international market. So while we're shooting the thing, he'll be like, you know, if we really want to get the Asian audience, we should do it like this way. And
yeah, he sounds crazy.
He's good at indoctrination, though, I think.
Helpful or wow? But yeah.
And just the whole, like, he's there before everyone. It's like, well why? Like, what, I mean, I was
recruiting.
If they talked about me, like, if I was, like, really famous, I'd be the odd. Like, he's there last every day. He doesn't know anyone's name.
Yeah. I mean, you do wonder sometimes, like, I don't know how you look at your career, but I always look at mine like one day something will be easier because of whatever, a certain amount of, like, fame, fortune, position. And then, like, you don't want to approach every single day like maybe they're going to fire you. Like,
that just seems like... Right. Which is, like, how do you think that's how he's kind of, like, approaching every single day? Like, I have to be there on time every day.
It's sort of like he has to be, I mean, he clearly gets off of it just on some level. But it is sort of like...
I mean, that sounds psychotic to me. I mean, like, I know even if you like your job, it just sounds, you get to a point where you're like, you've been doing it a long time. You can come in like a little, especially in showbiz when you're doing movies, because it's like you get there and you don't do anything for like 9 hours. So it's like, why do you have to be there before? I love how I'm like shitting on Tom Cruise. Like, this fucking loser. Obviously, it's working out.
All right, we gotta wrap up soon.
Okay, so we got to wrap this up. But Ophira, thank you so much for doing this.
Ask me another. It's a great show. How's Jonathan Colton?
How is Jonathan Colton? Jonathan Colton seems fine. I think one of his things is to always seem fine. I don't know if it's not real, but he always just seems like slightly sun-kissed and fine. He's been catching. Feral cats, part of the school where you can catch feral cats and try to rehabilitate them.
Oh, yeah. I heard someone else was doing that recently. I like that guy. He's always, he plays music and stuff. He's very talented.
It's impressive that you could even catch feral cats. I mean, I guess you have to, like, trap them or something.
Yeah, it's a trap. It's a trap.
Yeah. Perfect. All right, good. That makes me feel better. There's no way, because you can't, I always try and, like, there's feral cats, you know, in my sister's house upstate, and I always try, they won't let you near, like 500 feet of them.
No, so he's now conditioning this feral cat. He's been petting it with a stick, but it's been getting warmer and warmer. So,
social distancing.
Right.
That's what it's come to.
Yeah, you don't want to get COVID from your cat.
Yeah, that would be very embarrassing in heaven. So yeah, Ophira Eisenberg, thanks again. Check out her show, NPR podcast, right? Ask Me Another.
On the radio too.
Yeah.
All right, cool. We'll see. So I think you're on the show tonight, so I'll probably see you in about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay.
See you on the podcast.
He's a great comedian. So.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Great job. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks again. We really appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Okay.